once asked me to demonstrate. I told her that she had been very concerned about her love life recently and felt unfulfilled, even desperate. She was shocked and asked how I knew. It was simple. She was a 40-something woman without a wedding band, and most people are concerned about their love life. I made a high-probability guess and made it sound specific. Cold readers may also use information obtained through other means. When this is done, it's technically a hot reading. The most infamous example of this is the faith healer Peter Popoff. He would have his targets fill out prayer cards with personal information, including what health issue they wanted healed. He was caught by James Randi, a famous magician and skeptic who uses his knowledge of magic to investigate fraud, having his wife feed him this information through a radio earpiece while pretending to be inspired by angels. The art of cold reading also involves turning misses into hits. If a statement about the subject of a reading turns out not to be true, well, then maybe it's true of the subject's friend who is with them. TV psychics who work a crowd use this technique to great advantage, increasing the probability of a random hit by opening up their guesses to a room of 20 or more people. A miss can also be turned into a prediction. You haven't found a lost animal recently. Well, keep that one in mind. You will in the near future. But the most important element of a successful cold reading isn't the psychic, but the subject. Most people who visit a psychic, reader, or healer want to believe. They want a successful reading, even if they fancy themselves initially skeptical. Subjects will typically remember all the lucky hits and forget the misses, even egregiously blatant misses, so that the reader's performance will be all the more impressive in the retelling. A cold reading can take many forms. A straight psychic reading, tarot card reading, palm reading, reading the tea leaves, or even reading one's buttocks. Apparently, Sylvester Stallone's mother is an ass reader. The trappings really don't matter. You can cold read medical diagnoses. Iridology, for example, is the practice of diagnosing illness by reading the flecks of color in the iris. The techniques are the same, such as giving vague diagnoses like, "I see you have an issue with your liver." This isn't a specific diagnosis, just an organ. If the person has no known liver problems, then the iridologist simply says that the person has a susceptibility to problems with the liver. Pulse diagnosis is common in Eastern cultures, feeling the pulse for a long time to discern what is wrong with the body. One not uncommon pulse diagnosis is that the water is not flowing. This isn't a real diagnosis, and it's intentionally vague. When you think about it, this could relate to many real health issues, from bladder problems to heart blockage. Even though gaining information from the target is very helpful, especially for the observant reader, cold readings don't have to be done live. The reason for this is simple. It's the target of the cold reading that is doing all the work. They are making the connections and sifting through all the possible correlations in their life. The confirmation bias is all theirs. Think of the classic Twilight Zone episode with a young William Shatner, where he superstitiously believes that the little devil's bobblehead that's spitting out pieces of paper for a penny has real magical power. He is the one fitting the vague statements to specific events. This process is also referred to as subjective validation, which means people can apply very loose criteria ad hoc to validate a belief. For a time, phrenology machines were popular. They would measure the bumps on your head with an elaborate helmet, then give a readout diagnosing your ailments. This was nothing more than a prefabricated medical cold reading. Of course, the best TV portrayal of cold reading was from a South Park episode. Stan is trying to convince Kyle that psychics are frauds. Here is his demonstration. Stan: "All right, look, I'll show you. I just need a volunteer. How about you?" Woman 4: "Oh-ho, me?" Stan: "Okay. I'm going to pretend that a dead person is talking to me about you, okay?" Woman 4: "Okay." Stan: "Okay, watch, Kyle. It's an older man, someone very close to you." Woman 4: "My father?" Stan: "Does this month, November, hold a special significance?" Woman 4: "My birthday's in November." Stan: "Right, because he's saying, tell her happy birthday." Woman 4: "Oh my God." Stan: "See, Kyle, I just started with something really vague. I chose older man because I'm betting that, based on this woman's age, her father is most likely dead. but if her father wasn't dead, I could still say it was some other older man. Man 2. Well, how'd you know her birthday was in November? Stan. I didn't. I just asked her if November meant anything. Her father could have died in November, or Thanksgiving could have been really special for them. But I go with the birthday and validate it now, as if I knew, by saying he wishes you a happy birthday. Woman 4. What else does he say? Stan. Okay, I'll just use an old standard. He's saying, the money. Stop worrying about the money. Woman 4. Oh, my God. My sister and I have been fighting over his inheritance. Woman 3. That's amazing. Stan. No, it isn't. When a father dies, inheritance is usually an issue, and money is something everyone worries about. Man 3. That sounds a little too coincidental. Man 4. Yes, there's only one explanation. This kid can communicate with the dead. You should no more believe that someone is psychic because of a cold reading performance than you should believe that a magician can really saw a woman in half or catch a bullet in their mouth. These are all illusions. Cold reading can be a powerful illusion, however. The core of the illusion is the fact that most people underestimate the number of possible hits in their life. Our lives are filled with millions of details. Our brains are also very good at finding connections. Remember, data mining, pattern recognition, and coincidences. In this way, cold reading is related to the coincidence illusion, the sense that two events that happen to align could not have done so by chance. This fails to consider all the possible alignments that didn't happen. We likewise underestimate the probability of a guess by a psychic aligning with something in our lives. The probability actually is very high for any particular guess. So ultimately, the illusion is partly based on our own inability to grapple with the probability of very large numbers. Think back to the opening of this chapter. Did my cold reading trigger anything for you? Did your brain find any connections? What if I told you that your name is Mark and you work in the technology sector? How do you explain that? Listeners who just happen to be named Mark and work as programmers are really freaking out right now. Now that you know how cold readings are done, however, you are less likely to be impressed by the random hits of clever guessing. Even you, Mark. Chapter 32. Skeptic's Guide Entry, Free Energy. Free energy is the claim that the law of conservation of energy can be broken, that we can create some process that creates more energy than it uses. Such a process would create endless energy seemingly from nothing. However, a free energy device cannot exist, as it would violate the well-established law of conservation of energy. And no one has been able to successfully demonstrate such a device. I fully agree with you about the significance and educational value of methodology as well as history and philosophy of science. So many people today, and even professional scientists, seem to me like somebody who has seen thousands of trees but has never seen a forest. Albert Einstein. I have to say I love watching alleged free energy devices in action. They are often beautiful works of art in their steampunk complexity with numerous interacting moving parts. They are also little puzzles to be solved. Where in the workings of this device is the deception? Where did they go wrong? Some devices are black boxes. They spit out energy and we're not allowed to peek inside and see how they work. The contraptions are perfect monuments to the pseudoscience that created them. In December 2006, a Dublin company called Stern promised to demonstrate its Orbo device, which it claimed was capable of perpetual motion, of generating free energy. In November 2016, 10 years and $20 million later, Stern announced that it was closing up shop and liquidating its assets. The story of this company is a microcosm of the history of free energy devices and perpetual motion machines. The poster child for ironclad laws of science is the conservation of matter and energy. You don't get something from nothing. This means that anyone who claims to have produced a perpetual motion machine, a machine that can generate free energy or that produces more energy than it consumes, is simply wrong. They could be misguided, scientifically illiterate, a hopeless crank, have a tenuous relationship with reality, or simply be a con artist knowingly lying. But chances are they are not, as they would have us believe, a lone brilliant scientist who has succeeded where all others have failed in achieving the seemingly impossible. There is one characteristic that I found to be almost ubiquitous among free energy claimants, an utter lack of humility. This is a general feature of pseudoscience, but seems to be epitomized by the type of cranks who think they have surpassed the fundamental laws of physics. A free energy machine, also called an over-unity machine, is one that produces more energy than it consumes, or has greater than 100% efficiency. Unity means 100% efficiency, so over-unity means greater than 100%. Unfortunately, the laws of thermodynamics make such claims impossible. The first law of thermodynamics states that you can never get more energy out of a process than you put into it, and the second law states that you cannot even get the same amount of energy out. There will always be some loss in the amount of energy capable of doing work, also referred to as an increase in entropy. You can think of this in terms of the conservation of mass energy. Energy cannot simply come from nowhere. There has to be a source of the energy. These laws are so well established that, well, they are laws. Unlike mere theories or guesses, they're as well established as anything in science. Sure, scientific knowledge is always finite, but to claim that the laws of thermodynamics have been broken would be most extraordinary, requiring rock-solid evidence in order to be taken seriously. That's not what we typically get, however. As with Stern, we're usually given promises and dubious demonstrations. Stern gave one failed public demonstration of its Orbo device in 2007. They claimed equipment failure, that they would just turn a few screws and be back in no time. They also did a public demonstration in 2009 of an apparent black box-type perpetual motion machine, but it provided no actual evidence of perpetual motion and was rightly dismissed as a publicity stunt. Stern also challenged the scientific community to directly investigate their device. They did, and in 2009, the expert panel unanimously concluded that they hadn't produced perpetual motion. More excuses, more delays, more promises, and then they folded. There are various common ways that people convince themselves they have tapped into a source of free energy when they clearly haven't. Long-lasting motion is not free energy. One way is to create some kind of contraption that will keep itself moving almost indefinitely, such as a rolling ball or spinning flywheel. Such devices try to trick gravity, or they contain magnets that are supposed to give an extra kick and keep things moving around. These devices, as mesmerizing as they often are, can't possibly work, however. You cannot use some force like gravity or magnetism to create perpetual motion. You have to put in more work to move up the gravity well or away from the magnet than you get back from moving down toward the force. At best, engineers make toys that have minimal friction and can move for a long time, but you cannot get energy out of such systems. Missing all the energy inputs. There are demonstrations of small motors running off an external power supply, but with claims that, when the inputs and outputs are all added up, the energy output is greater than the energy input. Sometimes the claimants just get the math wrong, but most often they fail to properly consider or measure all the energies involved. They always seem to take their inventions to some lab or university and claim that their machine works. They typically find earnest but naive experts who may have physics or engineering expertise, but clearly aren't up to the task of investigating over-unity claims, just like the experts who prematurely validated Clever Hans. To date, despite countless claims, no one's free energy machine has stood up to proper investigation. Converting energy from one form to another. What continues to amaze me are those who think they've hit upon the secret of free, limitless energy just by rigging up some combination of batteries and motors. For example, using one battery to run a motor that is then used to charge another battery. This works, but of course at the end of this process you have less energy in the second battery than you had in the first. The motor makes noise and sparks. The light and sound it gives off is therefore carrying energy away from the system. I'm sure it's also heating up a little bit, and waste heat is another source of lost energy. That's why there will inevitably be less energy in the second battery. It seems that the inventors are simply surprised that such a motor can run for so long on just a battery, especially when you recapture some of the energy by, for instance, charging up another battery. They conclude that they're onto something special, and further conclude that they could scale up their motor and add an arbitrary load and it would still work. When this doesn't work, they assume the failure is due to some technical engineering problem rather than the fundamental laws of physics. So they endlessly tinker with their rig, claiming that it will work as soon as they fix the bugs. But it never does, and the only thing truly perpetual is the endless cycle of overunity claims. All we need to do is scale up. Another fallacy is to extrapolate from tiny amounts of energy and assume that the whole system can be scaled up. The problem here is that with small amounts of energy, subtle errors are easy to miss. When you scale up, those errors become huge and obvious, which is why the devices never work at large scale. That's why I say, run a house on your free energy principle and nothing else, and then you'll have my attention. Fraud. There are, of course, some scams thrown into the mix as well, not just the honest but self-deluded. The promise of free energy seems to be a good way to lure in those with more cash than scientific knowledge. It is a very good rule of thumb to be highly skeptical of any free energy claims. The person seeking to sell you a device, or often just the chance to invest in the development of a free energy device, may be sincere, or they may be just trying to con you. Lack of humility. There's always a certain amount of arrogance with such claims. An ounce of humility would lead one to assume that they were making a mistake rather than the invention that will transform our civilization and has eluded the scientific community for so long. I find arrogance to be common in pseudoscience in general. If you think you're the one genius who has broken the laws of physics, who will rewrite the textbooks, who has succeeded where countless others have failed before, then you should be really certain. Instead, we get ridiculously grandiose claims based upon intuition and overconfidence. Perpetual motion machines are the ultimate crank magnets. The promise of free energy is part of the appeal. Imagine if it works. Free energy devices themselves are a tangible metaphor for the crank mind. They're elaborate, often fascinating and even beautiful, and include a great deal of technical detail, but they're missing something essential for real science and progress. They are cut off from reality, removed from the scientific community. They are monuments to arrogance, and most importantly, they don't work. Chapter 33. Skeptic's Guide Entry, Quantum Woo. Quantum pseudoscience, or woo or mysticism, is the hostile takeover of the success and weirdness of quantum theory to support pseudoscientific beliefs and junk science. For all its beauty, honesty, and effectiveness at improving the human condition, science demands a terrible price, that we accept what experiments tell us about the universe, whether we like it or not. It's about consensus and teamwork and respectful critical argument, working with and through natural law. It requires that we utter, frequently, those hateful words, "I might be wrong." David Brin. Purveyors of pathological science, whether it's for acupuncture, homeopathy, dualism, or whatever, always desire a stamp of approval from science! Insert echo chamber effect. After all, science undeniably delivers the goods, and having its imprimatur would be a tremendous bonus. Since they have no real scientific support, however, they're content to make their nonsense at least seem scientific. After all, even a thin patina of fake science on top of snake oil is often enough to persuade many people. One effective strategy is to claim that your pseudoscience works because of whatever the latest scientific discovery is that most people don't understand, but sounds really cutting-edge and sexy. A couple hundred years ago, the newfangled scientific concept was electromagnetism. This gave birth to countless bogus magnetic devices and healing scams. The most famous of these was animal magnetism, promoted by Franz Anton Mesmer. He was ultimately debunked by none other than Benjamin Franklin, but his legacy continues to this day in our language. Animal magnetism, to Mesmer was an alleged magnetic force created by living things that he could manipulate to cure rich, anxious clients of whatever ailed them. Today, the meaning has morphed into sexual attraction. We also talk of people being mesmerized when something draws their rapt attention. Fast forward a century, and the new scientific marvel was radiation. This gave birth to all sorts of radioactive tonics and speculation about the magical powers of X-rays and other invisible particles that rip through your body. Believers extolled the virtues of regular radium tonics, and all the while they were slowly killing themselves with radiation poisoning. The Bailey Radium Laboratories of East Orange, New Jersey, sold a radioactive tonic they called Radithor, which they guaranteed contained, quote, at least one microcurie each of radium-226 and radium-228. They also guaranteed their product was entirely safe and certified radioactive. The market for such products didn't go away until they were specifically banned by the FDA in the 1950s. But fear not, there are always new scientific ideas to fill the void left by the older ones, those that have become too familiar to be ideal for shining up pseudoscience, although magnetism remains popular for this. Today, one of the most popular legitimate scientific ideas used to justify nonsense is quantum mechanics. Quantum theory is uniquely perched on the top of the heap of all sciences that could reasonably be expected to support wild paranormal theories persuasively. One reason is its unmitigated success. It has been so successful and so impactful that quantum theory and relativity are considered the premier scientific theories of the entire 20th century. This theory isn't just some obscure observations or laboratory curiosity. A significant portion of the world's gross domestic product is completely based on quantum mechanics. Transistors, computers, lasers, even the World Wide Web would not exist without quantum mechanics. You are bathed in its influence from the time you get up to the time you go to sleep. More importantly, in its study of the forces and particles and behaviors of the atomic world, quantum theory has revealed a fundamental reality that is as wildly counterintuitive and bizarre as it is beneficial and innovative. My three favorite manifestations of this wackiness are superposition, entanglement, and tunneling. Superposition is the fundamental tenet of quantum theory that turns the most heads. Imagine all the distinct attributes that particles can have, such as spin, mass, and velocity. Some of these attributes can be polar opposites, like spin up and spin down, but particles actually exist at times in a freakish state called a superposition, in which they're both spin up and spin down at the same time. This state is fragile, however. It persists only until the particle interacts with the environment and settles into one specific spin orientation, a process called decoherence or wave function collapse. The concept of entanglement takes superposition and puts it on steroids. Imagine a quantum system with no inherent spin. If two particles emerge from that system, they will have opposite spins, such as an upspin and a downspin. Since the original system that spawned these particles had no inherent spin, they can't both be up or both down due to conservation laws. They can both be in a superposition of up and down, and they can also potentially travel millions of light years through the relative vacuum of space in this state. If one of these particles is hit by another atom or is measured by an alien scientist, it will decohere into either spin up or spin down. When that happens, however, the other particle, quintillions of miles away, will necessarily have to be the opposite spin. How could it know instantly, on the other side of the visible universe perhaps, which spin its partner chose? This is unknown. Yet the fact remains that there appears to be some type of superluminal connection between such particles. If that's not enough head-spinning atomic behavior, let's look at quantum tunneling. This refers to a phenomenon in which a particle moves through a barrier that classic physics tells us it shouldn't be able to. One way to describe how this happens is that it is due to quantum theory's wave-particle duality. This means that what we think of as point-like particles can also be described as extended wave-like entities. Particles are therefore often in, you guessed it, a superposition of both wave and particle at the same time until they interact with the environment. An electron wave, therefore, can have a tiny part of its wave-like leading edge extend just past a barrier. Therefore, a small percentage of the particles will decohere on the other side of the barrier. If scientists and laypeople can accept such a fundamentally weird reality, is it really too much to ask that this wild theory can also support mind reading, the fundamental interconnectedness of all living things, or any of the host of paranormal ideas attributed to quantum mechanics? In a word, yes. The overall allure of quantum theory for the mystic is that it is so counterintuitive. It's only counterintuitive to us, however, because we evolved in a macroscopic world where quantum and relativistic effects are not apparent. Quantum mechanics is so counterintuitive, in fact, that even Albert Einstein had trouble accepting it. He made his career, among other things, from having the vision to realize that relativity theory was not just a mathematical trick. The world actually worked that way. When you get closer to the speed of light, time and distance actually change. Space and time are the variables, while relative velocity is the constant. Very weird to someone evolved in an environment where nothing moves that fast. But Einstein realized it was a fundamental aspect of how nature works. Then, toward the end of his career, while other physicists were essentially saying the same thing about quantum theory, that things like superposition and entanglement were how the world actually works at that scale, in this case very small rather than very fast, Einstein balked. He figured we just didn't understand what was really going on. So we can be forgiving when non-geniuses today have a hard time wrapping their brains around relativity and quantum theory. But this leads to the potential for pseudoscientists to say, hey, I know my claims are weird and fantastical, but quantum theory is weird and fantastical, so therefore I may be onto something. That's when common misconceptions about quantum theory can cross the line into quantum woo. Author and alternative medicine guru Deepak Chopra is perhaps the most well-known proponent of quantum woo. His books and frequent lectures often invoke the word quantum to explain a host of New Age beliefs. The role of consciousness in the universe seems to be especially interesting to Chopra. He has said the following. It was only with the advent of quantum physics that scientists began to consider again the old question of the possibility of comprehending the world as a form of mind. Indeed, the quantum theory implies that consciousness must exist, and that the content of the mind is the ultimate reality. If we do not look at it, the moon is gone. In this world, only an act of observation can confer shape and form to reality. This very common misconception stems from the idea that it takes a conscious measurement or an intelligent observation to collapse a superposition, wave function, and force reality to choose its reality. This is wrong in multiple fundamental ways. As I described earlier, it's not specifically the act of observation that removes a superposition, but interaction with the environment, mindless decoherence. One atom randomly bouncing off another will therefore do just as much as the most conscious mind experimenting in the atomic realm. Chopra's moon comment exemplifies a common theme in quantum woo, that the bizarre phenomena of the quantum realm bubble up easily into our macroscopic realm of everyday life. This is simply untrue. Decoherence is so universal that once you start looking at anything much bigger than an atom, the weirdness starts disappearing. That's why quantum computers and similar experiments are so hard to pull off. The high level of isolation or extreme cold required to demonstrate quantum behavior is exceedingly difficult to maintain. By the time you start dealing with macroscale objects with millions to quintillions of atoms, all interacting in some way, any quantum behavior is long gone, replaced by more classical Newtonian mechanics. The objects of everyday life are essentially decoherence machines. This is what modern quantum mechanics is telling us. For Chopra to think that the moon is in some superposition that requires the regard of a conscious mind to be fully actualized shows that he has left modern quantum theory and is well into quantum woo-land. Actually, I think he is the mayor of quantum woo-land. Somebody give him a sash. In short, quantum theory doesn't prove that consciousness is fundamental to the universe, that the universe itself is conscious, or that we control reality with our minds. And entanglement does not mean that all things are interconnected in such a way that we can use it to explain telepathy, or the distant effects of planets and stars required for astrology. Entanglement is indeed weird, and we don't fully understand it, but it's a fragile state that only occurs in special circumstances. Our brains, macroscopic objects that they are, aren't entangled with each other. By now, you may have recognized that quantum woo is often used as a giant argument from ignorance. It's often invoked as something we don't fully understand, and therefore my magic is real. I say, if you don't understand quantum mechanisms, then just don't invoke it as an explanation. You might embarrass yourself to the dozen or so people in the world who actually do understand it. Extra geeky aside, theoretically, even large objects haven't lost 100% of any quantum weirdness. The wave-particle duality applies to objects like the moon or even people. Objects have a quantum wavelength called the de Broglie wavelength, which can be thought of as a measure of their quantum effects. Your corresponding wavelength, however, would be orders of magnitude smaller than an atom, meaning that your wavelength is for all intents and purposes zero and can be safely and completely ignored. In other words, no quantum weirdness at the macroscopic level. Chapter 34. Skeptic's Guide Entry, Homunculus Theory. Homunculus theory is a class of medical philosophy that assumes one part of the body contains a functional map of the entire organism. The claim of alternative practitioners to not treat disease labels but the whole patient allows alternative practitioners to live in a fool's paradise of quackery where they believe themselves to be protected from any challenges and demands for evidence. Edzard Ernst. Before the advent of science, medical systems were philosophy-based. This means that they were built on an idea or philosophy that wasn't established by science. That idea or philosophy was an organizing principle used to explain and make sense of health and illness. Such notions, however, were isolated ideas, not based on evidence or woven into a deeper understanding of how the universe works. For example, most cultures believed in a type of life spirit or force that animates living things and makes them different from non-living things. Health and illness were explained using the idea of a life force, with illness resulting from the force being weak, blocked, or out of balance. In the West, the concept of four bodily humors was popular for almost 2,000 years, without being based on anything real. Sympathetic magic was also common, the notion that substances contain an essence reflecting what they look like. Powdered rhino horn, therefore, should make an effective aphrodisiac. One philosophy that seems particularly quaint to modern ears is the notion that one part of the body, quote, maps out to the rest of the body. For example, the foot contains one of these so-called maps. The attempt to diagnose health by reading the map of the foot is known as reflexology. Iridology measures well-being through studying the iris, and the touching of the features and forms on the palm's surface to determine salubriousness is known as palmistry. These are just three examples of a homunculus theory of medicine. The word homunculus originated in the 17th century when the practice of alchemy was still in its heyday. Alchemy is the attempt to transform matter, turning lead into gold, for example, by using magical concoctions, incantations, and ceremonies. Contained within the belief system of alchemy is the idea that a single sperm contains a miniature person, fully developed, merely scaled down to sperm size. The mini-me inside a sperm is capable of birth without the requirement of fertilizing an egg. How? According to one of the more interesting ideas of the famous philosopher and alchemist Paracelsus, 1493 to 1541, the process is as follows. Let the semen of a man putrefy by itself in a sealed cucurbit with the highest putrefaction of the venter equinus, horse manure, for 40 days, or until it begins at last to live, move, and be agitated, which can easily be seen. If now, after this, it be every day nourished and fed cautiously and prudently with an arcanum of human blood, it becomes, thenceforth, a true and living infant, having all the members of a child that is born from a woman, but much smaller. Despite the grotesque description, the word homunculus is in this context synonymous with little man. And it is from this the term is borrowed to describe the various practices of mapping an entire body through one of the body's features. For reflexologists, the foot is the little man of the body. For iridologists, the eye is the little man. For palmists, the little man is the palm. Homunculus philosophies of health and medicine lack both evidence and plausibility to be understood as anything other than a belief system. There is no underlying anatomy or physiology that can explain how the iris, the foot, or the palm could reflect the state of function of any other part of the body. Despite this, these ideas have endured the test of time, hundreds of years in some cases, and are still in practice today, with eager practitioners and willing customers. Homunculus theory is mainly a desire for simplicity, to subsume all the complexities of biology in one nice, neat little system. It would be wonderful if we had a map of the whole body, somewhere we could just read in order to make detailed diagnoses, or massage or poke with needles to treat illness. This theory also reflects pre-scientific and pre-digital thinking. Before advanced technology, people understood the notion of templates. Templates were used to make clothes, and molds were used to make precisely identical items. It's an easy idea to understand. Therefore, when trying to imagine how a baby is made, it makes sense to reach for the familiar, to think that there must be a little template of a person in the gametes. Furthermore, there are real homunculi in your brain. For example, there is a motor homunculus, a motor strip in your cortex that actually does map to your body. These are real connections. Those brain cells give off axons that actually go to all the parts of the body through the spinal cord and nerves. Developmentally, this is called somatotopic mapping. When the brain is forming, it maps itself to neurons connecting to other parts of the body, along both the motor and sensory strip. This also works for the retina, which maps to the visual cortex. We can see the brain's homunculi when we map the brain's function, and we can follow their connections to the body. There is no such evidence, however, for the alleged homunculi in the foot, iris, or palm. There's no connection between one particular spot on the sole of your foot and your liver. There are other sorts of pseudo-mapping systems, such as acupuncture. Acupuncture points allegedly map to different parts of your body, including the organs. And even chiropractic, straight chiropractic specifically, postulates that the spinal cord and the vertebra map to different organs in your body, even when those nerves don't actually go to or provide any kind of nerve supply to those organs. All these different kinds of mapping systems, and therefore homunculus-based theories of health, are pure pseudoscience. That, however, didn't stop the 2010 Jerusalem International Conference on Integrative Medicine from accepting an abstract based on a newly invented homunculus system. The abstract was submitted by Dr. John McLaughlin, who later published the results of his prank in the BMJ. He presented case reports and testimonials, which, he claimed, established the usefulness of butt reflexology. That's right. He just superimposed the real homunculi from the brain onto a schematic of human buttocks and invented a new alternative medical system. His abstract was gleefully accepted for presentation at the conference. See your PDF for the illustration. There are some general lessons we can derive from the history of the homunculus. First, beware of simplistic systems that purport to explain complex phenomena. Usually, the world turns out to be more complex than we think, not simpler. Also, if you can't think of a possible mechanism by which something can work, then be skeptical. This may just be a deficit of knowledge on your part, but an expert should be able to give you a reasonable explanation that you can understand. And be suspicious of ancient pre-scientific ideas. They really had no clue. So unless their ideas have been reasonably demonstrated and explained by modern science, they probably are as nonsensical as they sound. Think of Paracelsus and his putrefaction of the sperm. He was what passed for a scientific genius back in his day. Chapter 35. Skeptic's Guide Entry, Intelligent Design. Intelligent Design, ID, is the notion that the complexity of the universe can only be explained as the result of an intelligent force, a designer. Critics maintain the idea isn't a proper scientific theory because it is fundamentally unfalsifiable. Design in nature is but a concatenation of accidents, culled by natural selection until the result is so beautiful or effective as to seem a miracle of purpose. Michael Pollan. In 1996, Michael Behe published Darwin's Black Box, a book he hoped would take the scientific community by storm, posing a serious challenge to the theory of evolution and solidly establishing intelligent design as a legitimate scientific alternative. He failed miserably on both counts, as have all his ID colleagues, because he failed to realize the core problems with ID, not the least of which is that it simply is not science. The core belief of ID, according to the Discovery Institute, the main organization promoting this idea, is as follows. Intelligent design holds that certain features of the universe and of living things are best explained by an intelligent cause, not an undirected process such as natural selection. The primary scientific criticism of ID is that it isn't a legitimate scientific theory, but rather a transparent attempt to recast religious faith, creationism, in scientific-sounding jargon. ID lacks the minimal criterion to be considered science, falsifiability. ID proponents, of course, reject this argument because the entire purpose of ID is to disguise creationism as a scientific theory. Much of the discussion on this topic focuses on the specific point of whether or not ID can be falsified. Can it theoretically be proven false by scientific evidence? If it can, then it is at least potentially scientific. If it cannot, then it is forever outside the realm of science. This creates a dilemma for ID proponents. They desperately want ID to be considered legitimate science. That is, in fact, the entire reason for its existence. But they cannot allow for it to be actually falsified by scientific data, for that again would defeat the purpose. As an example of this strategy, let's take a look at an essay from Jonathan Wells of the Discovery Institute. He is responding to an essay by Francis Collins, a geneticist who accepts the science of evolution and is highly critical of ID, but is also a devout Christian. Wells wrote, "More surprising is the fact that Collins is here citing experimental evidence against a theory he maintains is unscientific because it is not open to experimental testing. In claiming that evidence from gene duplication disproves ID, Collins is demonstrating that ID can be tested with scientific evidence. Either ID is unscientific, in which case evidence is irrelevant, or evidence can be cited against it, in which case ID is scientific. Collins can't have it both ways." It's actually Wells who is trying to have it both ways, citing evidence against ID to demonstrate that it is falsifiable without acknowledging that it has been falsified. Nice trick. This is the game, pretending ID can be falsified, but then always keeping it just out of reach of scientific evidence so that in practice it can never be falsified. There are actually several problems with ID that render it unscientific. Asking the wrong question. ID is based upon the false dichotomy that design in nature is necessarily intelligent and evolution is an undirected process, incapable of producing design. ID proponents have carefully crafted their premise, design equals intelligence, evolution equals random. Then all they have to do is show the appearance of design in nature and claim that ID is verified. The fatal flaw in this strategy is the failure to recognize that evolution is capable of producing design, because it's not a random process. Natural selection is the non-random survival of organisms based upon their inherited traits. Mutation and variation are random, and the long-term path of evolutionary change is best described as chaos. But natural selection allows for the non-random accumulation of favorable changes. So the ID proponents are asking the wrong question, always a fatal problem in science. The question is not whether or not there is design in nature, but what the nature of that design is. Evolution is a bottom-up process whereby design and complexity emerge out of blind but non-random processes. Quote, intelligent design, by contrast, is a top-down process where the final result is known ahead of time by the designer and is achieved with purpose. There are many analogies we can draw to illuminate this difference. For example, a city that grew over decades without any central planning, based rather upon the decisions and actions of individuals acting in their own interest, is like an evolved city. An ID city, however, is one planned and mapped out ahead of time by a committee, corporation, or some other body. In the evolved city, there will still be design. Streets and utilities will follow residences and businesses, for example, and shops will tend to pop up and survive if they meet a demand. But it will be messy, with lots of redundancy, and with abandoned buildings where neighborhoods collapsed or businesses failed. Streets would likely not be optimally arranged. A planned city, however, would look vastly different, more clean, purposeful, and direct. The streets would be laid out in a deliberate way, one that probably would not have emerged spontaneously with use. The difference between evolved and top-down designed life would be even more stark. Buildings and entire city sections can be torn down and rebuilt, so some top-down design can always be imposed later. But biological systems are far more constrained. Bottom-up evolutionary systems can only work with the raw material at hand. They can't start from scratch, develop new organs or limbs wholesale from nothing, or completely eliminate unneeded bits of anatomy. If we ask the correct question, does life display bottom-up or top-down design? The answer is obvious to anyone with sufficient knowledge of biology and an unbiased mind. Life is overwhelmed by the features of bottom-up design. From the vestigial eyes of cave salamanders to the bits of viral DNA junking up our genome. But none of this can falsify ID because they're still asking the wrong question. Common descent. It's important to recognize in any such discussion that evolutionary theory actually has multiple components. The fact that life's diversity arose through evolutionary branching descent over time, the specific mechanism or mechanisms of evolution, and the particular pathway of evolution taken by specific branches of the tree of life. One important line of evidence for the first claim of evolution, that life arose through branching descent, are the many biological similarities among various species that demonstrate not only common descent, but also a branching pattern of descent predicted by evolutionary theory. For example, there is evidence from gene duplication that over time one gene can become duplicated as a mistake of replication. Descendants will therefore have two copies of a gene instead of one. The duplicate copy is then free to change over time through mutations, essentially free to experiment with variations of function, because the original gene copy is able to carry out the original function of the gene. The duplicate gene may therefore hit upon a new function that helps the original gene carry out its purpose, or perhaps it may become co-opted for an entirely different purpose. Biologists can examine the sequence of base pairs in genes to map out their relationships with other genes, and in that way they can build a detailed map of which genes evolved from which other genes. What we find when we compare such maps among species is that they fit into a nice pattern of branching common descent. There are multiple other independent lines of evidence that also demonstrate not only branching descent, but a reasonable overlap. The different lines of evidence generally agree about which species evolved into what, when. These lines of evidence could have completely falsified evolution. It's possible, for example, that we could have found patterns of gene variation that were incompatible with the theory of common descent. If we bring this back to the question of whether or not ID is falsifiable, we have to ask, is there a pattern of gene variation we could have found that could potentially falsify ID? The answer, apparently, is no. At least, I'm not aware of any ID proponent making such a prediction that was open to falsification. This is where we also get into the "it depends" answer. As I stated above, evolution has various components, only one of which is common descent. Some ID proponents, like Michael Behe, actually accept the fact of common descent, They think that life did change over time through branching descent. They just don't think this process was due to natural selection acting on variation. They think it was guided top-down by an intelligent designer. So evidence of common descent isn't evidence against this form of ID. What about those who do not accept common descent, those who, like young Earth creationists, think that life was created more complete, that the designer didn't spend millions of years making slow changes over time, but poofed life into existence pretty much as it is? Evidence for common descent does falsify such claims. Or does it? In theory, yes it does. And those like Wells are now using this to argue that ID is science because it can be falsified. But in practice it doesn't. Because ID proponents and creationists who reject common descent make the argument that the intelligent designer could have chosen, for their own unfathomable reasons, to make life so that it has the appearance of branching descent. The "God can make life to look like whatever he wants" defense renders the beliefs of anyone who makes it unfalsifiable. So, either way, this line of argument does not make ID falsifiable science. Irreducible complexity. This is the primary line of argument by its proponents for the falsifiability of ID, and it's the core concept of Behe's book, that we can look for design in biological nature by looking for structures, bits of anatomy, and biochemical pathways, reactions necessary for life, that are irreducibly complex, meaning that they could not function if they were any simpler. The biggest problem with this argument is that, once again, it's based upon a false premise, and one that was chosen to achieve the desired result. The premise is that if a structure could not function for its current purpose, if it were any simpler, if any complexity were removed, then such a structure couldn't have evolved because it couldn't have passed through simpler forms to get to its irreducibly complex state. Because evolution requires that in order to be selected, a structure would have to provide an adaptive advantage every step of the way. The iconic example is the mousetrap. Take away the spring, or the base, or the lever, and it cannot function as a mousetrap. Therefore, the mousetrap is irreducibly complex. Superficially, this sounds reasonable, but it has been shown to be a false premise. And yet, the ID crowd won't abandon it. Specifically, the premise ignores the possibility that an irreducibly complex structure could have evolved from a simpler structure that served a different purpose. A favorite example of ID proponents, first proposed by Behe, is the bacterial flagellum. The bacterial flagellum is fairly complex, and Behe argued it could not function without all its complexity, and so it could not have evolved. However, the flagellum could have evolved from a simpler tube that couldn't move, but was used to inject substances into another cell. This simple syringe could have been an evolutionary stepping stone to the more complex flagellum. And in fact, evidence now supports this hypothesis. The premise is also false because natural selection isn't the only force operating in evolution. There is also genetic drift, which is random variation not under selective pressures. Remember the gene duplication example I just mentioned. A redundant copy of a gene is free to drift, producing changes that can at some point stumble upon a crude function. Even the slightest reproductive advantage from the most rudimentary of structures would provide a toehold for selective pressures to take over, fine-tuning the new structure. In practice, the notion of irreducible complexity contains two strategies. The first is to argue that a biological entity could not be simpler even in theory, which we've proven invalid. So ID proponents fall back to their second strategy, arguing that evolutionists haven't fleshed out the actual evolutionary history of an apparently irreducibly complex structure or pathway. But this second strategy is nothing more than an argument from ignorance. It relies upon our current state of knowledge and assumes that currently unknown equals unknowable, and further, that unknowable means impossible, impossible for evolution. Therefore, we need to invoke an intelligent designer. An argument from ignorance, basing a conclusion on what is not known, is always a weak argument, because it doesn't require any positive evidence for a theory. It's just knocking down a competing theory. What has happened since Behe made his initial claims for irreducible complexity is that scientific progress has continued, and many of the holes in current knowledge that Behe relied upon have been filled in, like the previous bacterial flagellum example. What implications does this have for the question of whether or not ID is falsifiable? Well, it establishes that specific claims used to support ID are falsifiable. We have now falsified the claim that the bacterial flagellum has no simpler evolutionary antecedents. Wells and others use this to say that ID is therefore falsifiable. But once again, in practice, it isn't, as is evidenced by the very fact that Wells, Behe, and others have not abandoned ID because the flagellum argument was proven wrong. This is because when one argument falls, they simply migrate to another. They even state that in order to falsify ID, evolutionary scientists would have to flesh out the complete evolutionary history of every biological component. This, of course, is an impossible and absurd standard. What they're admitting, without meaning to, is that ID is ultimately a God of the gaps belief, and the only way to falsify it is to close every single last gap. The false dichotomy. The notion of ID falsifiability has a deeper logical problem. ID is defined entirely by what it isn't, namely evolution. ID is based upon the claim that evolution cannot explain life. This is a false claim, but even if true, it wouldn't be evidence for ID. So ID proponents spend their time trying unsuccessfully to poke holes in evolutionary theory and point out gaps, all the time pretending that current gaps are somehow evidence for ID when they aren't. If ID proponents had an actual theory, they should be able to say something about the features of intelligently designed life, predict what we should find. And these features can be looked for to see if their design predictions pan out. So far, they have not been able to do this. Their answer to this is irreducible complexity, but as I explained, this doesn't cut it. What they won't do is make any statements about the intelligent designer. What marks would such an intelligence leave upon creation? No one appears to know. When pressed, they often play the "it's a mystery" card. How can we possibly fathom the intelligence necessary to design and create life? Evolution, on the other hand, does make many specific predictions about what evolved life should look like, predictions that have been validated. Evolution's successful positive predictions are a problem for ID, but they deal with them by arguing that the designer could have arbitrarily and inexplicably decided to make life look as if it evolved. To put it another way, if your theory is compatible with every possible observation, then by definition it is not falsifiable, and it is therefore not a scientific theory. Since the intelligent designer, by which, let's face it, they mean God, can, according to ID proponents, create life to look like anything, no possible observation of life can falsify such a designer. The challenge that remains open for the ID community is to state a specific prediction about what positive evidence should be present if life were top-down intelligently designed. They cannot do this. Perhaps the Discovery Institute, if they were overcome by an uncharacteristic spasm of intellectual honesty, should change the definition of ID to: intelligent design holds that certain features of the universe and of living things were caused by an intelligent agent who, for reasons we do not care to go into, chose to make the world look exactly as if it were the product of random variation and natural selection. Chapter 36. Skeptic's Guide Entry, Vitalism and Dualism. Vitalism is a belief that living things are animated by a life force, or a vital force, that gives them not only the quality of being alive, but also their essence. Dualism is the same concept applied to consciousness, that the mind is more than or separate from the physical brain. Science does not aim at establishing immutable truths and eternal dogmas. Its aim is to approach the truth by successive approximations, without claiming that at any stage final and complete accuracy has been achieved. Bertrand Russell. At a recent skeptical conference, there was a kiosk in the hotel selling energy bands. These are cheap rubber and plastic bracelets that are claimed to improve your health or athletic performance by balancing or supporting your, quote, energy. We asked the vendors how they worked, and they gave us the usual line about vibrations and life force. I don't think they really cared. They were just trying to make a living.